The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Good afternoon, counsel. We'll call 4-20-0653, People of the State of Illinois versus Taiwan Bruce. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Zach Pollack, P-O-L-L-A-C-K, on behalf of Mr. Bruce.
Thank you. And counsel for appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
My name is David Manchin with the Appellate Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the state.
Thank you. Mr. Pollack, you may proceed.
Thank you. Again, good afternoon, Justices, counsel. May it please the court. Again, my name is Zach Pollack and I represent the appellant, Taiwan Bruce. Taiwan was found guilty by a jury in McLean County of several charges, the most significant of which was first degree murder. The trial court sentenced him to 45 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections. In his briefs, we alleged that several errors occurred in the trial court, which do entitle him to a new trial, and he requests that this honorable court vacate his convictions and remand to the trial court for a new trial. The first error that we allege involves evidence that was submitted of Taiwan being involved in a fight at the McLean County Jail with an individual named Jarrell Dudley. Originally, the people sought to introduce this evidence of the fight between the two as consciousness of guilt because Mr. Dudley was a witness to the case, and allegedly Taiwan called Mr. Dudley a snitch. Eventually, it came out that Mr. Dudley did not wish to testify, but that was on the fourth day of trial. So there's two parts to this. First is whether the trial court erred in first allowing that evidence to be admitted. And second, once the evidence was admitted and Mr. Dudley didn't testify, what were the consequences of that?
Well, so, Mr. Pollack, the evidence wasn't admitted.
Correct. However, the foundation for the evidence was laid on the first day of trial by a correctional officer named Hitchens.
Right.
He testified to Mr. Bruce being in the McLean County Jail.
Which you don't complain about.
Don't complain about it. I think, you know, obviously the jury's going to be able to figure that out by themselves.
You say in your reply brief, Taiwan does not complain about the fact that the jury knew that he was in jail for his offense. So you clearly conceded that as an issue.
Sure. And I think that was in response to the appellate prosecutor's argument that the jury is smart enough to know that someone being tried for murder is probably in jail.
So your complaint is that they saw that still photo of him in jail garb.
Correct. As well as the testimony that identified that he was in a fight in jail. So basically the first part of that is whether the trial court made an error in admitting that evidence at all. And we submit that it was an error just because the fact that Mr. Bruce called Mr. Dudley a snitch doesn't rise to the level that many of the cases involving consciousness of guilt do tend to. In those cases, specifically the ones cited
by... You're arguing the evidence that didn't get admitted and didn't get heard. I understand the argument about being seen on the still,
right,
being seen in jail garb.
Right.
But you actually argue as a separate issue error in the admissibility of the evidence that didn't get admitted and didn't get heard.
Right. And my argument on that issue is that, and I get that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because the evidence didn't get in. However, the judge's initial ruling on that evidence did allow that foundational testimony in.
Well, but that's a separate issue. So I can understand raising that as an issue.
Okay.
The first one really doesn't, to me, honestly, just doesn't make much sense since it's nothing that came before the jury and it wasn't heard.
Right. It may be a bit duplicative of my second argument. I just do think that based on the information that the trial court had prior to allowing that the testimony of Officer Hitchens and that, the jail video in was enough that the trial court should have rejected it outright. And had the trial court rejected it outright, the foundation never would have been laid.
Okay.
Now the reason we argue that is because you have a fight between an individual and another individual in jail for calling him a snitch. It really doesn't.
They don't know that. Jury doesn't know any of that.
Correct. And I'm just talking about the arguments that were held in front of the trial court. This is the information that the judge had prior to making his decision.
I'm just suggesting that you've got a limited amount of time. You might want to get to the issues that would have some significance.
I will move on, Judge Justice. Okay. Thank you. Now, as far as the accompanying argument that Taiwan's due process rights were violated when the jury viewed the photograph of him in jail garb and heard the testimony that he was involved in a fight in jail. Now, obviously, this is, again, the foundational testimony. They did not hear Mr. Dudley testify. But it's well established that a defendant cannot be compelled to appear in jail garb in front of a jury because it undermines the presumption of innocence and suggests that that defendant has a propensity to commit crimes.
Trial counsel agreed to a curative instruction.
Correct. He also did object prior to the still photograph being admitted to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he clearly objected to it.
Yes.
But then when it was brought to the court's attention by Mr. Lawson that Mr. Dudley was not going to testify, the court pointed out that the counsel had been discussing a potential curative action in the event that either the testimony would not be allowed or, in this instance, the state not calling Mr. Dudley as a witness. Court explained the process, asked if the defense counsel agreed, and he said, yes, please.
Correct.
Okay. So once that curative instruction is proposed, and once counsel agrees that that's the proper way to address it, where's the error?
It's my suggestion that curative instruction wasn't sufficient, and that counsel was ineffective for essentially not asking for a mistrial at that point. I don't believe that the curative instruction was sufficient, and I realize that most cases do say that a curative instruction given at the time of the decision that the evidence is no longer admissible typically cures that error. However, in this case, the sequence of events is on the first day of trial. You have Officer Hitchens' testimony, which puts in the minds of the jury that Mr. Bruce was in jail and that he was involved in a fight at jail, basically showing that he does have the propensity to commit acts of violence. I think based on the fact that the jury—
If we say that's error, if we say it's error, why would it not be harmless?
I believe it's not harmless because that jury sat through three more days of testimony with the photograph that was projected on the projector in their mind, along with the knowledge that Mr. Bruce was involved in a fight.
You don't think they had a few other things to think about by that time?
I think they had plenty of things to think about. There was a ton of evidence in this case. There were a ton of witnesses. But again, I think because of the proximity of the instruction being a couple days further away from the actual exposure, I think the curative effect was lessened. I think in my reply brief, I cite the Hall case, which suggests in a case where the evidence is close, the evidence is substantial, and there's a substantial outcome or penalty that would come from a guilty verdict, I think that this is a similar situation. I think that the evidence was close. I realized there was a lot of it, but it was all circumstantial. There were no smoking guns. No one testified that anyone pulled the trigger. A lot of it was based on statements made by the defendant, as well as a very comprehensive montage of video showing a vehicle traveling around McLean County. But I do think this was a close case based on the evidence. I also think that because there was so much evidence, really, any one thing could tip the jury's verdict. And I think that we're arguing that because they had that picture right away, that it was in their mind the whole time. Finally,
when a jury is given a curative instruction, are we to presume that they follow the court's instruction?
I believe that's what the case law says.
Okay.
However, I do think that this is a case where even if, you know, the jury is presumed to have followed it, you've got a big enough issue with defendant's due process rights because he was in front of the jury in jail garb, and there was evidence of a fight, which again, wasn't supposed to be admitted after everything happened. I do think that the curative instruction wasn't sufficient to give Taiwan significant due process. And I do think that that could have affected the outcome of the trial. I'd like to address a couple other arguments that were raised regarding this issue. Again, the appellate prosecutor suggested that Taiwan waived this argument by failing to cite case law. We did cite Estelle v. Williams, a Supreme Court case, and People v. Wilkes. It's a Fourth District case. I understand that there's not a case directly on point, but this is a pretty unique set of facts. And I believe that the underlying principles of Estelle do suggest that in this case, there should be, there was error and that it was a reversible error because of Mr. Bruce appearing in the jail garb and the evidence of his, of the fight in jail. Also, I think we did address the fact that defense counsel did object to the publishing of that photograph. I believe the appellate prosecutor raised an argument on that. And the people do cite some cases in the Estelle jurisprudence. I think those cases are distinguishable because you don't have a set of facts similar to this one. Each of those cases dealt with a brief situation where a defendant's being led to a cell in handcuffs. You know, there was a case where testimony was involved where co-defendants went to go visit an individual in jail. Again, there's no photographs of that individual in jail. And then finally, there's a case where the jury observed the defendant being led away after trial. But in that case, presumably he was in street clothes and not jail garb. And I think all those cases that did find that there was harmless error really don't apply in this case, just because, again, you have at the onset of trial, Mr. Bruce being projected on a screen in jail garb, and you have the added effect of the fact that the jury was told that he was involved in a fight. Now, as far as my ineffective assistance of counsel arguments related to the video, I realized that the option of making a motion for mistrial is within the sound discretion of a trial counsel, and it's usually trial strategy. And I do realize that in this case, the trial court did say that it would not have granted a motion for mistrial in the post-trial motion. However, I think in this case, bless you, it's a unique situation, again, where you do have something that, you know, the trial court did use the expression, the cat's out of the bag. I do think once the cat got out of the bag, you do have enough prejudice against Mr. Bruce that mistrial was required in this case, and the trial counsel was ineffective for failing to make that. As far as the trial court,
Pollack, can you point out in Officer Hitchens' testimony where he referenced your client being involved in a fight?
Your Honor, the specific reference to Mr. Officer Hitchens' testimony regarding the fight, it's not explicit. What it is the state identifies, I believe it's Exhibit 23, which is the disc that contained the fight. Right. They asked Mr. Hitchens, Officer Hitchens, what that was, and he said, that's video of the fight that occurred that day. So that's the only part of the record that does involve reference to that fight occurring, where the jury heard it.
Because when he's asked to actually identify individuals, he doesn't say anything about a fight, and the picture is not of a fight.
Correct.
So they don't have any way of knowing what, if, or how your client was involved in, do they?
No, the jury has no specific information about who was involved in the fight. But I think that the fact that he's up there testifying and identifying individuals and identifies that a fight happened, I think that's a reasonable jump for the jury to make that Mr. Bruce was involved in a fight.
Counsel, you argue that, if I understand correctly, that the image of defendants wearing jail garb during Hitchens' testimony was error, it shouldn't have happened, is that correct?
Yes.
And the state argues that this is minor, and if error at all, it should be subject to the harmless error analysis, is that correct?
Correct.
So my question is, in applying the harmless error analysis, is this an instance where this court would have to be, would have to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict obtained, or simply that it was harmless error without the need to determine it beyond a reasonable doubt?
See, I'm not exactly sure on that one. I apologize.
Well, isn't the latter applicable when we're dealing with constitutional rights, such as questions of whether the right of confrontation had been violated?
Yes.
There's no constitutional right at issue with regard to the question of the jail garb, though, is there?
No, it's not a specific constitutional right. It's a due process argument.
Okay, go ahead. You may continue.
Thank you. I was just trying to reset myself. I appreciate it. We raised several other arguments that don't have to deal with the photo of Mr. Bruce in jail garb. One is the foundation for the videos that were admitted. I recognize that the foundation for video evidence these days is very low. However, in this case, there were situations where the state didn't even elicit testimony of what was on the actual videos. And I think that it was error.
Why wouldn't what was on the videos be evident when you see the video?
I think our issue with that is the testimony that happened to lay the foundation for the videos occurred separately from the actual playing in the videos. The videos were actually shown not individually, but in a montage. I believe because it was a montage that was not agreed to by defense counsel.
Did he object?
He did object on certain grounds, although I know.
Did he object to the montage?
He did not object to the full montage. He objected to specific videos in the montage for various reasons, including reliability due to timekeeping issues. He did not.
The ones they objected to were the ones where the times didn't match up. But then what they would do is they would take a picture of the actual time and the time on the video to show how far the disparity might be, didn't they?
Correct.
Okay. Yes.
And there was testimony to essentially sync those up produced by the state. An additional argument we make is the admissibility of that Louis Vuitton belt and the video showing an individual holding the Louis Vuitton belt. Again, this is a unique red belt that was allegedly taken from the murder victim's house. The court allowed the admission of a video that was purportedly taken from Mr. Bruce's, I believe it's Snapchat or Facebook, of an individual holding that belt.
Didn't counsel acknowledge that was taken from his phone?
Yes, I'm not.
Nobody disputed that video came off of his phone.
No, the foundation was laid that it did come off his phone. However, my issue is that it was more prejudicial than probative because essentially you have a person holding a belt. There's no identification of the individual holding the belt. There's no caption from the Snapchat that was admitted into evidence. So without more, I don't think that there was sufficient probative value to admit that evidence because it certainly was prejudicial given the other testimony regarding the red belt in the courts. So I think
counsel,
I'm-
Counsel, isn't that the classic, you know, it's for the weight of that type of evidence is for the trier of fact. You've got a missing belt and you have a similar distinct belt picture taken from the suspect's phone.
Correct. Yes, it can be weight. However, there was really no testimony regarding how unique this belt was. We didn't know how many was produced. We don't know, you know, where it was available. So without
we have to when we're looking at circumstantial evidence.
I think there has to, especially when you're arguing that something is unique, I do think there has to be some evidence to show that the individual item is unique.
Okay. Giving up your motion to continue issue?
Your Honor, I think it's briefed well enough. I believe that, you know, with the issues with COVID, trial counselor clearly made the argument that because of COVID, he wasn't allowed to fully prepare. So I do think
he just said that he had a little more difficulty talking with his client.
Correct. And I think, you know, in a case that's of this magnitude with this much evidence, I do believe that difficulties with a client communicating could lead to a negative outcome based on inability to prepare.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pollack. Your time's up, but you will have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Manchin.
May it please the court, counsel. In this case, defendant has raised seven different issues, and I will touch briefly on ones that have been discussed here today. Regarding the question of the continuance, I think the trial court's decision was not an abuse of discretion. The continuance was sought primarily on grounds of COVID, that the attorney was afraid that COVID would disrupt the trial, or that they'd be unable to get enough jurors, or that the a COVID outbreak would require a mistrial in the middle of trial. His only complaint was that he was having more difficulty talking to his client because of COVID restrictions. He never made any statement that he was not prepared for trial. And the record shows that he had been the attorney for many months, had sat through the trial of
20 months,
had sat through the trial of a co-defendant, and his performance at trial did not show any kind of problems due to any kind of lack of preparedness. So I think the court's decision on the continuance was correct. With respect to the question of the belt, the uniqueness of the belt is established by the very photograph showing that is not your typical brown belt with a buckle. It's a very distinct type belt, and it was specifically identified by two witnesses as the belt that had been owned by the victim. That belt had been on the table the day before the murder. The day after the murder, the belt is gone. 3 days later, a photo of that belt appears on the defendant's phone with the caption, "This bitch is official," I believe was the language on the photo. I think that is relevant to the question of defendant's guilt and questions as to who took the photograph or how it came to be upon the defendant's phone just goes to the weight of that belt and not its admissibility. Getting to the question of the defendant in jail clothing in the one photograph. In my recollection of the record, there was no reference to a fight in Officer Hitchens' testimony. If my recollection is incorrect and counsel is correct that he said that the video was of a fight, I still submit that there was no prejudicial error to the defendant in the procedure used here. The trial court never made any ruling as to the admissibility of the deadly fight. He expressed the reserved ruling upon that until after defendant had been given full disclosure of everything the state had in regards to the fight, including Dudley's last minute statement that the defendant called him a snitch during the fight. So to say that the jury was at most told that there was a video of a fight in the jail. From there to leap to making the leap that it was the defendant in the fight is a very long stretch. And when the jury is expressly told twice, first, ignore Officer Hitchens' testimony and ignore the testimony and ignore the photograph. Then in the final instructions, they're told to ignore any evidence or exhibits that were stricken. The jury is presumed to have obeyed that instruction and that there is no indication that the jury ignored that instruction. In fact, the trial court, after trial, the defendant got a new attorney who raised questions of ineffective assistance of counsel, including the attorney's failure to seek a mistrial based upon the photograph when Dudley did not testify. So he was ineffective not to seek a mistrial instead of the curative instruction. But the trial court expressly ruled on that and said, no, the instruction was enough to correct any problems and to indicate that there would have been no mistrial. So that there can be no ineffective assistance of counsel in that regard, and no finding of prejudice should be found based upon the trial court's ruling that the instruction was sufficient to cure any possible error that could have arisen just for the fact that the defendant was shown in jail garb. Defendant has conceded that the jury was likely to know he was in jail. So how is it prejudicial for them to see a photograph of him in jail clothing, which tells them what he admits they already know? Plus, I think this is distinct from the cases cited by the defendant where the defendant sits through the entire trial in jail clothing. I think this is more analogous to the cases where the jury is briefly led to know that the defendant is in custody by seeing him in handcuffs outside the courtroom. I think if this was a case where the defendant was brought to the courthouse in jail clothing, changed clothing there, and then he made a court, and one or more of the jury saw him being brought into the courthouse, the result would be more analogous to the cases where they see him in handcuffs. And I think this is no different than that. Plus, I don't think this seeing a picture of the defendant in custody could have had any impact on the jury's verdict. The circumstantial evidence in this case was overwhelming as pointing to the defendant as the as being involved in this offense. You have his admissions, his statement that he planned the robbery, his admission that he was there and it was only supposed to be a robbery. You have his statement before he leaves the apartment, I want to rob Evers in Dover. He then leaves with several people. One of them has a gun of the type used in the offense. The other one has access to a car shown to be driving in the vicinity of the offense within 10 minutes of the offense. So I think all the links proved him guilty. With respect to the surveillance videos, the defendant made a number of objections. I admit defense counsel made a number of objections to the videos, but he never objected on the basis of lack of foundation, on the basis that each officer was required to describe what he downloaded onto the disc that was later produced in court. So the lack of an objection means that on foundational grounds means that this court should find a waiver. And the trial court in making its ruling on the admissibility of the videos, went through all the factors that are involved in the silent witness theory, the capability to record, the identification of the locale, chain of custody. So there was no abuse of discretion. What the evidence showed was that the video cameras in these various locations were operating. The very fact that they were able to produce videos of the streets outside these premises at that particular time shows that they were working. The police explained the procedure of going to businesses located along the suspected route of the perpetrator at or about the time of the murder as established by the 911 call. They downloaded that information, and the people at the various locations testified as to the location of the cameras, how the cameras worked, whether the fact that they were, depending on the location, either running all the time or motion activated, so they would only film when something moved in front of the camera. So under the silent witness theory, I think the trial court properly admitted the various videos. Plus there's no real extreme prejudice from these businesses showing the trail of this gray Camry through the neighborhood. The defense counsel expressly said that the Bloomington police videos from police cameras in the area were admissible. Those police cameras, so to speak, showed the same gray Camry going through the same general area.
Counsel, I have a question about the Camry and it's being seen on all these various cameras. Mm-hmm. Do any of the videos show anyone ever getting out of or getting into the Camry?
They just show the Camry going through the area. They also show the Camry leaving the murder scene, going the wrong way down the street. The tire tracks in the snow at the scene shows that a vehicle left going down the wrong way.
Well, your theory is that the defendant and at least one other person was in the Camry at that time?
Yes.
How do you explain the absence of anyone getting in or out of the Camry on video? What accounts for that?
Well, there was no camera directly across the street from the either place where the defendant left or where the crime occurred. They were just videos showing the Camry in the area at shortly before and at the time of the offense. The evidence also showed that the tires on that Camry were changed after the date of the offense and after photographs of tire tracks in the snow were published in the newspaper. And the type of tires that were on the Camry before the offense were shown to be the type of tires that would make that type of track that was in the snow outside the crime scene, outside the murder scene.
Whose vehicle was it?
I believe it was Grampsus was the co-defendant that was associated with the car. And this court, I believe, affirmed his conviction not long ago.
His grandmother.
Theory of accountability.
His grandmother's car.
His grandmother's car, but he had access to it.
The tires that were on it that matched were only 5 months old when they were changed for four different tires.
Correct. After
pictures of the tires were published in the newspaper.
That's correct.
The tire tracks.
Correct.
Mr. Manchin, what's your understanding in the record as to when law enforcement first became aware of the vehicle? Is that simply parsing together the car traveling through the area, or was there something that said we're looking for this camera?
I think there was, they had talked to some witnesses, and there's, I do not recall any express testimony as how they zoomed into a gray Camry before they were looking at the videos, other than the fact that they knew the time of the offense and they talked to witnesses. So presumably they had talked to some witness that had linked Grampus to these offenses beforehand, but there's nothing, no explicit testimony that I can recall as to how and why they focused on this gray Camry, other than the fact that there was testimony, if I recall, this may be, I handled both Grampus and this trial, so I may be mistaken using testimony from Grampus, but there was testimony, I believe, that there was little traffic at this time of day, so focusing on the one vehicle that you see traveling would be understandable. But as far as how they knew to look at for a gray Camry at the time they were looking at the videos, I don't think the record clearly states that. I think unless the court has any other questions regarding the other issues, I believe I have responded to everything adequately in my brief, so I will stand on my brief with respect to any of the other arguments.
All right, thank you, counsel. I see no other questions. Mr. Pollack, rebuttal. You're muted.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I disagree with counsel that the evidence against Mr. Bruce was overwhelming. He does acknowledge that almost all the evidence in this case is circumstantial. You do have some statements by Mr. Bruce indicating that he was aware of a burglary going on. He was aware that some individuals stole some marijuana from the alleged victim. However, he never is alleged to have admitted directly to committing any sort of murder or, I believe, being there on that night. The Camry evidence doesn't reveal who was in the Camry. They never stopped. No one ever got out of the Camry, and the windows were sufficiently tinted so that no one could observe who was in the Camry. As far as the testimony regarding the party that was held where the victim, Edgerton Dover, attended, there was testimony regarding not only Mr. Bruce being upset about Mr. Dover not sharing marijuana, there were several other individuals that expressed their displeasure at that issue. So there clearly were more than one individual at the party who did have an issue with Mr. Dover's behavior. So I do think that, again, it's not overwhelming evidence of guilt that Mr. Bruce did participate in the murder. As far as the photograph of Mr. Bruce not really having an effect on the jury, again, I would reiterate my earlier argument that this is one of the first things that the jury saw of Mr. Bruce. They learned that he was in jail garb. I, again, understand that they're going to figure out he's in jail if he's awaiting trial for murder. However, the very fact that it's blown up on a big screen, I do think resulted in prejudice, coupled with the fact that the curative instruction wasn't given until a couple of days later. With that, unless there are any questions, again, I'll rest on my brief.
All right, I see none. Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court will stand in recess.